I came out of that first stint in rehab, and that's when I discovered painkillers. That's when it started to take on a life of its own. Adderall as a pick-me-up, Xanax on a regular basis. I'm married at this point. My wife doesn't really know what to do with me. It has been something that has been slowly destroying our lives for probably like 3 years.
So that is the voice of my friend James D. He's 41 years old. He's sober since February 23rd, 2016. My name is Mike, and this is another episode of Keep Coming Back, Real Stories of Sobriety and Recovery. I met James very early on and in both of our sobrieties. He's got about 4 months longer than I do. And you know, we've stayed close ever since. And it made me think about something that I heard in those early days that always stuck with me, which was the idea of being part of what was referred to as the, quote, no matter what club. And don't get me wrong, AAA has plenty of corny expressions that are, you know, sayings that are on the wall, acronyms that you hear all the time, and this one's right there with them. But it was something that was important to me to hear then and now, and I'll explain why. When I first got sober, in many ways, I was already planning my future relapse. Like, I wasn't sure if this was for life. I thought maybe, like, I'll just dry out, get things under control. And I even refused to delete certain phone numbers in case one day I wanted to pick up. And you guys know the phone numbers that I'm talking about. I thought maybe, you know, future events that could happen, which would be, you know, excuses to pick up, like a romantic breakup, the death of someone close to me, a work failure. I had like this whole laundry list of tragedies, maybe a surgery that would give me permission to go out. And I kept going to meetings and I'd hear about people who went through these hardships, who went through the things that were already on my imaginary laundry list. And they'd say, but I didn't drink no matter what, because I knew that a drink would only make things worse. And there was this other guy who'd sit in the back of the room. And at the end of every share, he closed with, quote, and I've stayed sober for the last 30 years because long ago I gave up on the idea that a drink or a drug was any form of relief for me. And him saying that shattered a very old belief for me, which was simply that this was going to make me feel better. And so over that year, I heard about people going through surgeries, experiencing death and divorce, personal sickness, getting cancer, and they said that they couldn't drink no matter what. And these last 6 months that we're in now provided ample excuses for me to go out and drink. Being alone in my apartment for, you know, all this time, working from home, riots in the streets, looting in the streets. This election is on Tuesday, and I'm hearing about all these residential buildings in New York that are hiring outside security in case of rioting. But for me, none of these situations get better and most likely will get worse if I pick up a drink. A couple of reminders before I get to the interview. Please take the time, if you can, to leave a review on iTunes. It really does make a difference. If you want to write in, sometimes I do read them on the air. I was actually planning on it next week. It's at KCB on Instagram. It's keepcomingbackpodcast@gmail.com if you want to write me. And so with that said, here's my conversation with James. Outside of a few people, no one knows my story as well as you do, and I know your story pretty well too. Your story from the outside looks like this, to me, like all-American story, right? Like you were, walk me through this, right? Amazing athlete, right?
Yeah, I played small college athletics. I played two sports and had some success there, yes.
Great family.
Yep, great family, healthy family. I'm the only known addict alcoholic in my immediate family. Very healthy.
Big family too, right?
Two parents, Irish Catholic, suburban Boston, didn't want for anything. Very healthy, yes.
No alcoholism. You go to college, you come out, you do what a lot of guys in our industry do. You move to New York and you start working in finance.
Sure, correct.
And you're killing it there too.
Things are going well.
Right. What happens? And that's the big question. It's like, okay, well, how do I even answer that? But if I just said to you, okay, so everything's going great, what happened?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it was progressive. You know, they talk about this being a progressive disease, and I think I'm no different in that regard. I think, You know, I think I took on a certain identity when I came to New York. I think you referenced the athletics. I think that's something that kept me out of trouble through college in certain respects because I had a passion for playing sports. And, you know, alcohol and drugs don't go hand in hand with that. But I experimented enough that when I came to New York, I had some experience around drugs and alcohol. And I started to take on the identity of, you know, the work hard, play hard. And, you know, I'd make sure that I took care of things at work, but I would party, you know, pretty hard, you know, Thursday through Sunday. And that started to kind of take on a life of its own as I got into my mid and late 20s.
Right. And that's the thing is, like, when I look back about one, you know, I think what kept me out there as long as I did, you know, because I couldn't get into this room until I was 35. You were about the same, right?
Yes.
And so for me, it was, how bad could it really be? Meaning, right. I have a good job. On paper, things look great. I got a good job. I'm dateable. Like, girls are seeming, I don't know if the relationships are good. Actually, I know they're not good.
Right.
But I'm able to land myself in bad relationships. I'm making money. I'm, like, making it to the gym. Things, how bad could they be?
Right.
And it all goes back to, like, what is my interpretation of what an alcoholic is?
Sure. Yeah, and I think, you know, for me, there started to just be some consequences, right? Like, things started to get a little bit out of hand. And then the frequency at which things would get out of hand, some consequence, you know, involving a female, hurting someone, getting in a fight at a bar, blacking out. Like, those things started to happen with a little bit more frequency. When I'd wake up and I'd have a room full of people looking at me like, what did you do last night? Or what happened to you? Or what's wrong with you, type of thing. Nights started to crop up where I had for all intents and purposes, I was going out for three or four drinks with a buddy. And suddenly I was by myself, you know, in New York City. And I was in a cab by myself going home at 6 o'clock in the morning. And I had to be at work at 7, right? Those nights started to crop up.
And that goes along with the, you know, I'm in New York. Everyone's doing this, right?
Sure.
In my head, everyone's doing this.
Sure.
But then there I am alone at 6 in the morning.
And that was kind of the tipping point for me, right? I was probably around 30. I'd been in the city living that life for 8 years. You know, and it would be called a Tuesday night and it's 5:45 in the morning. I'm at the back of a yellow taxi and I'm kind of like having that moment with myself, like, my friends don't do this.
Yeah.
Like, my buddies went home a long time ago. There's something wrong with me. And I think that's when it started to, you know, it started to crop up as something to be aware of, but I still had a lot left in me in terms of discovery around, like, whether or not I was an addict or alcoholic. That wasn't the thought.
But then there's the other part, which is, I have discovered I'm an alcoholic. I know I am. I want to stop, I think, but I have no idea how to stop. So people talk in meetings a lot about this idea of, like, I lost the power of choice.
Right.
Does that mean something to you?
Yeah, of course. I mean, so how my story went, it was, I developed a drinking problem, right? I never drank alcoholically in the sense that I never drank every day. But when I drank, there started to be consequences, like I said, and I'd get into heavier drugs. When it started to, and you know, I realized I definitively had a problem with alcohol. I did not think I was an alcoholic. That said, because of my family stepping in and essentially asking me to get some help because of the consequences, I actually did get some form of help in the form of rehab. I had a short stint at rehab. And then when I basically made the decision, right, I was still holding on to a lot of self-will. And I felt like that I had just been working too hard and, you know, I needed to get some therapy. I needed to get some sort of outside help, but this was something that I could control. Anything that James puts his mind to, he can get control of. And I came out of that first stint in rehab, and that's when I discovered painkillers. And that's, to answer your question, that's when it started to take on a life of its own in terms of I lost the power of control,
right,
or the power of choice.
So going back to, you know, a lot of my drinking and a lot of people in this program's drinking and using involves some sort of double life, because the way that I want to use the level of highness that I want to get to isn't suitable for public display at some point along in my journey. And therefore, I have to hide it. I have to be alone. And so how did your family start to catch on, I guess, to the point where they wanted to send you to treatment?
So my family situation was pre-painkiller addiction. So right. I came home over the holidays 1 year, and I was in really rough shape. You know, I'd been in a physical altercation.
How old are you at this point?
I'm probably 29 at this point.
Okay.
I'd been in a physical altercation in the city. I wasn't myself. There had just been enough. I have four brothers and sisters. I had a girlfriend at this time. There had been enough like disgust around things that, you know, people had heard me do or that I had done that they just felt it was time to get some level of help.
And so then what happens? You get out
of
treatment.
So then I get out of treatment. I basically convince my family that this is it's a self-help issue, right?
Right.
I need to help myself. I need to get a therapist. I need to pay attention to my emotions and feelings more.
And to someone who doesn't know recovery, that's a compelling argument.
Sure. I still had that level of fear around those nights of coming home at 6 a.m. and I was trying to... You know, how do I avoid that, right? Like, I want to have controlled drinking. That's when I started to have the idea of, if I'm going to drink, I won't drink to get drunk, right? So I went down that road. I then started to come into painkillers, right? I had a friend who started to get access to painkillers, and I had experimented with them before and used them recreationally like other drugs. But I started to get access to them in a way that I could get basically as many as I wanted to. And I had the financial resources to buy as many as I wanted. And
unlike drinking, easy to hide.
And it's easy to hide. And when you talk about a double life, I mean, that's the life of a dope addict, right? You're using on your own in secret. And you're not just using on your own in secret from time to time. If you're a true addict like I was, a true junkie, you're using every 2 or 3 hours. So in terms of the double life, I mean, it wasn't something that like, I did from time to time. I did on the weekends. It was a full-time job. I mean, it was part of my everyday life. I kind of equated it to, you know, people use the restroom a handful of times a day, right? Double that, and half the time I'm going to just use, and half the time I'm going to use the restroom and use.
Right.
And so I think that's when I started to, and there was, you know, there was that clearly that period of time where I was living the double life, but it was working for me, right? Painkillers, unlike other, you know, drugs and alcohol had an effect on me, but didn't have the powerful effect that painkillers had on me. I felt like when I started to use painkillers, it made me the person that I was meant to be,
in the sense that
I had supreme confidence. I had endless stamina. I felt extremely serene. I just felt like I was a better version of myself. I was fearless.
Yeah.
I was motivated. I had these grand aspirations and I had ideas around how I was going to accomplish them. And the crazy thing was for a period of time, it actually did work for me.
Yeah. It works until it doesn't.
Right. It worked for me worked for me in the sense that no one really knew. You know, there was a few people that knew, my dealer. From time to time, my friends, you know, I'd be going to the bathroom a lot, you know, so they were suspicious. But I'm pretty certain at that point, no one knew the level of use. And I think that lasted for about 2 years.
So I've been asking everyone this to sort of describe for me the story that sums it up how you drank, how you acted when you drank, and what you were like the best.
Sure. So like one story that comes to mind that I think is... It was towards the end, and this is when, you know, we're now probably 6 years into full-blown addiction. So I've been using more or less nonstop for 6 years.
Right.
Painkillers, and now I'm taking Xanax on a regular basis to come down if I feel like I need to come down a little bit. I'm taking Adderall as a pick-me-up. And so I have anywhere from 60 to 70 pills in my pocket on my person at all times. So... Call it six and a half years in. I had gone and gotten help again. I had done some participation in a 12-step program and relapsed. So I had tried to actually really access what I believed to be the solution in some way, but had not fully committed to it, had not consistently continued to commit to it and relapsed. And so at the tail end of my last relapse, I was probably using anywhere from 40 to 50 painkillers a day.
What, like the Percocet 10s?
10 milligram Percocet, yeah. Primarily. That was my drug of choice. Some combination of Xanax and Adderall, sometimes at the same time.
Yeah.
Right? Which I makes get that. No sense, yeah. Right?
At the end, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
I'm taking Ambiens at 2 in the afternoon,
right.
At the end.
So I would, those nights were kind of a blur, right? Like I would be, and this is where it's like the stories aren't really that cool. Like I'm using on my own. I'm by myself, right? I'm married at this point. My wife doesn't really know what to do with me. She's basically, we're living together, but not really.
She's aware of what's going on.
She's aware. At this point, it's been, it has been something that has been slowly destroying our lives for probably like 3 years, right? And so it was like another night of me using, and, you know, I had always kind of calculated what I can use and when in the day, depending on what I had to do. And I made a miscalculation, and I went to work, and, you know, I work in a corporate environment, and to kick off the day, our team has a big meeting in a big conference room with a bunch of executives that stand around a room. And they go through a lot of the news and the things of the day. And so there's probably, 25, 30 executives in this room, and I'm sitting at the table and I pass right out, like head flat down on a table, right? Yeah. Passed out. I kind of remember this. I remember coming to, and I remember having like 15 to 20 text messages into my phone with some of the team members texting me like, what's wrong with you, right?
Yeah.
So humiliation and absolute humiliation. But I'm so tone deaf, right? I'm so delusional. I'm so sick at this point that I don't really give a fuck.
And also, I think it's important to note, it's like, well, if you're working for this financial institution and they see this is happening, why don't they just fire you and kick you out? And the reason is because you're still a productive member of this team.
Right. And there were people that, I think they authentically did care about me, right? And they were worried about me.
Yeah.
And I think... I also, to be quite honest, I don't know that people really knew much of what was going on. I think they knew something was wrong, but didn't know the extent of it.
Yeah.
Because as addicts and alcoholics, we're actually pretty good at hiding it for a period of time. So my boss, who I had a very close relationship, comes up to me after the meeting and he looks at me and he's like, and I think it was a Thursday, he said, go home. He's like, I don't know what's wrong, but take tomorrow off. He's like, figure yourself out. Like, I don't know. I really don't know what's going on, but... I really need you to kind of help yourself. And so he handled it in a way that, any, I think, good manager would handle it. And what do I do? Right. I basically get an out, and what do I do as an addict and alcoholic? Right. I walk out the door. I call my drug dealer. The first thing I did was call my drug dealer. I worked in Lower Manhattan. There's a helicopter pad that's down in Lower Manhattan. I call a helicopter service, I charter a helicopter by myself, and I go to Atlantic City, right? I get a bunch of drugs, I get a helicopter, I go to Atlantic City. Like, think about that rationale, right? Like, I have this job, I have a 15, 16 year career that I've worked extremely hard at. I basically blow myself up as much as you probably can blow yourself up in the workplace. You kind of get another chance from your boss to kind of get a breather. And the first thing I do is, I continue upon a path of absolute self-destructive behavior.
Yeah, but at the same time, I get it because it's like, I just humiliated myself.
Right.
My relationship with my wife isn't where I want it to be.
Right.
I want to just go hide and I don't want anyone to see me. Great. Right. Let's get on a helicopter and go to AZ.
And I'm by myself, right? Like that's where we go.
Yep.
Right. So it's that escape, like you're referencing, it's that checking out. And if it's like, all right, well, if I'm already down this rabbit hole, like I'm going to see it through. So went to, go to Atlantic City and this type of thing, some version of this had happened on a number of occasions. And so I couldn't give you the blow by blow of what happened in Atlantic City. I know I gambled a lot, I know, I caused a lot of trouble. It was very vague. And what I do remember is I remember coming home, I think it was a day later, maybe it was a day and a half later, walking in my apartment. I'm 37 years old at this point, right? Walking into my apartment and my parents are there, right? Yeah. Like someone else is there, someone from my family. There were instances where my brothers were there. Like they don't even live in New York. They live 4 hours from here. So somebody in my family, maybe it's a friend, right, is at home. Because my wife doesn't know what to do with me, right? She's in the background or not even
there. Is she the one that called in the family?
She's checked out. Yeah, most likely, right? I don't even know, right? And it's just that moment of you walk back in and there's people looking at you. And just that look of fear and sadness and kind of like what's happened to you. And you having to sit with the idea that you honestly have no fucking idea what's wrong. You just know you're completely and utterly out of control.
Yeah. So the next step is I'm going to rehab for real.
Yeah. I mean, sure. Eventually, enough had happened where, you know, in the end, not too far after a trip like this, I would do enough at work to get through the day, and I would come home and I would use by myself. There was a handicap bathroom in my building, in my apartment. I wouldn't even go into my apartment, and I would just use there, and I'd be by myself for hours on end. Finally it came time where the timing was synced up such that I felt like I needed to finally get the help that I needed. And the point that I had to get to, as you know, any good kind of ego-driven alcoholic addict, even though my personal life was in complete disarray, my marriage, my family life, my life with my friends, is I had to give up on my career. I had to basically say that I was done. And that was kind of the last straw for me in terms of I'm going to walk away from my career and I'm going to actually go get some help. And when in hindsight, when I think about that, it's insane, right? Like, there's probably five things that are more important than my career, right? Including all of the people around me that love me and that I love. But my addiction had literally hijacked all of that. And the only thing that I was hanging on to was my job.
It makes sense to me only because, like, I worked in a field like yours, and I certainly worked at a place that would have been supportive had I made the decision to say, hey, I need to go someplace for 30 days. But there was just some sort of shame in just waving the white flag and being like, I can't hack it. You know, I didn't want them to know. And yeah, I mean, I thought about like, oh, I'm not going to make money for these 30 days. But it was beyond that. It was like there was the shame of like, I just can't make it.
Right. Yeah. And I think I had those experiences prior. I think the point at which I had to get to was I'm going to die. Yeah. I'm going to die. Or I'm going to get help. And so when I finally came to that point, you know, the career stuff was put in its right place.
So you get on an airplane.
Yeah, I bought a one-way ticket to Southern California, went out to Los Angeles, Western Los Angeles. And I basically made a commitment at that point that, and I had known enough people in sobriety that had good sobriety. And I basically made a commitment that I'm going to follow every single suggestion that people give me.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that started with rehabilitation again. So I went to rehab, did 30 days of rehab. I then lived in a halfway house. I still remember there was a point in time where I was getting ready to leave rehab. I knew I was going to stay in LA. But I had this idea of maybe I'll just get an apartment on my own, right? Or with another guy from the rehab. And then I had to go back to that commitment that I made to myself. Well, what's the safest step? What's the best step for me? What's the most conservative approach? What's the most aggressive approach with this disease? Go to a sober house.
Yeah.
Go to a halfway house. So like there were moments where I had to kind of get, where I had to bring myself back to that original commitment. And so moved into a sober living facility. I lived there for 3.5 months. You know, and during that time, I threw myself into recovery. It became my life. I think that, you know, when I think back to why I had some level of success, early on, was I think back to moments in rehab when I really was scared shitless. Like I was unsure as to whether or not this was something that I was going to be able to get control over or not. I think my previous attempts, I was of the mindset that I'm going to figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
I think I finally submitted to the fact that I'm not going to figure this out. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to find people that can help me, and I'm going to listen to what they suggest and what they tell me to do. And then I'm going to see where it goes from there.
The tricky thing about a recovery room when you first walk in is they are delicate with you, not to say you have to do everything, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. they carefully use the word suggestions. Mm-hmm. They always say, these are the suggestions. Mm-hmm. And me personally, when I first walked in, thinking I was so terminally unique, which is they say, take suggestions that you want and leave the rest. And I decided to leave most of the suggestions on the table. And in my case, one of those was that I didn't consider myself an alcoholic yet because I came in with a painkiller addiction, right? Meanwhile, I was addicted to everything. So for you, did you have that issue too, where you're like, well, painkillers brought me in. I'm going to AA rooms. Am I an alcoholic?
This time around, no. I think previously, because I didn't know the severity of my situation prior, there was probably some level of that. This time around, because of my level of addiction to everything, and where that had brought me, I recognized that any mind-altering substance was very dangerous for me.
So have you, at this point, you're in LA, you're married, mm-hmm. though. So what role is your wife playing in your recovery? What role is your family playing in your recovery at this point? Or are you just sort of isolated from the world?
So I think my wife and I were talking. She was supportive. She basically looked at me when I was leaving and said, just go as long as you need. So I think while she was supportive, I think she basically had found some level of comfort in kind of trying to just take care of herself and disconnecting from me in a way. Focusing on her career, focusing on herself. So she was supportive in the sense that she hadn't left me yet. My family was supportive as well, but I just think that the emotion that everybody in my family and anybody that cared about me, friends, former work colleagues, they were just scared. They were just, you know, scared of, and there was just a lot of fear. One thing that I do want to talk about when you bring up that question that I think of, and I think of it often. When I was in early sobriety this time around, I didn't want to be around anybody that wasn't in recovery or that wasn't working on their recovery in some form, whether it was drug addiction, alcoholism.
What that means to me, and I understand what you're saying, is like when I'm feeling really sort of confused and I'll say misunderstood, when I walk into a recovery room, I feel understood by everyone in that room.
So what I would say, how I would say it is, I think for the first time, I knew I didn't know anything about my situation in the sense that I think I knew I was starting at zero. Mm. And to your point, the only place that I really felt any level of comfort was around other people that were dealing with the same thing. You know, I think that was an important moment for me. I still remember going to dinner. I think I was like 30 days or 28 days, and they let us go to dinner in town. And I still remember feeling how uncomfortable I felt just in public.
Yeah.
Just being around normal people, doing normal things. So I think there was some level of listen, I'd been on drugs for 6 years. So I think there was just some level of coming off of that. So just my neural system was shot, you know, physically I was shot. I was, you know, on paper, I was just facing all of these issues. I had legal issues, I obviously had career issues, I had marital issues. So just there was just that warm blanket of being around people that knew on some level what I was going through. And so, you know, that lasted for probably a solid, you know, 4 or 5 months.
Now, this wasn't your first time you'd walked into an AA meeting or a recovery meeting. So speaking from my own experience, the first time that I walked in, the first few times I walked into meetings, especially afterwards when like people would stick out their hands or they would want to get my number, I was so guarded. And I was like, you know, my idea was like, what's your agenda? You know, like, right. What do you want from me? Why do you want my number? Like, are you trying to sleep with me? Like, what is going on? What did you think?
I mean, I think like anything else, I think there was, are you talking about like in sobriety this time around or like
just let's talk the about evolution this of it? Time around?
Yeah, this time around, I mean, there were reservations around that. Yeah, sure. Like things would come up and I don't know. I think it's kind of your disease talking to you. Like, you know, what's this guy's agenda? Like, what's his role in this? Like, why is he doing this for me? I think back to my earlier point, I think I just tried to shut all of that out and really just recognize the fact that I need these people in this room, the people with good sobriety in here, they have something that I don't, and they're doing something. And I'm just going to follow their suggestions. I'm just going to continue to follow their suggestions. And I think what was important for me is, I think in a lot of ways, I'm kind of all or nothing, right? And I think because I had the opportunity to kind of really throw myself in recovery, those early days were really important for me in terms of finding a sponsor, starting to go through the steps, attending recovery meetings on a daily basis, because I started to actually build some momentum around it. And that allowed me to, the things that you may typically have reservations about, that allowed me to kind of work through those. And as I started to get results, and results in the form of how I felt, like one thing that I always think about is, in the very early days, I found a home group near the rehabilitation clinic and the sober house that I resided in. And I would go there at 7 a.m. in the morning, and I would usually come out of that meeting, once I had a little bit of sobriety, I would come out of that meeting and I'd usually maybe check in with somebody at home. I'd call my dad or I'd call my mom or I'd call somebody. And I could tell by the way that I was talking to them and communicating with them, I was giving them a tremendous amount of like ease because of the way that I was. And I'd get off those calls and I'd take note of it. I'd take note of how I felt. On paper, my life was a disaster, right? My life had probably never been worse in terms of whether it was legal ramifications, whether it was my career outlook, whether it was, I don't know what my future looks like, I don't know what my marriage looks like, but I felt like everything was gonna be okay. And so when you talk about things that happen around the rooms in terms of people sticking their hand out, the things that are just new in terms of the social exercises that take place in fellowship, I started to gain a lot of comfort around it once I just said, you know what, just listen to what people have to say and follow their suggestions. And once I did that, I started to have that feeling that I referenced like after the call, after the meeting. And I was like, this is actually working for me, yeah. Right?
It's easy to see in a meeting. It's actually pretty obvious who the people you wanna sort of cling yourself to are. They are the people that seem to sort of exude the program, they exude happiness. Now, another commonality about those people is that they have pretty much bought into the God aspect of the program, which is difficult for a lot of people. So when you walk into the recovery room this time around and you see God all up all over the walls, how do you feel about it?
I think once again, like I tried not to pay too much attention to it in terms of, did I believe in God in that moment? Was I spiritually fit? Probably not. I believed in something, right? Like I just didn't, like anything else, I couldn't define it. Like right. I couldn't define anything at that point, right? I was just so raw. I think like anything else, I just said, I'm going to get a sponsor. I'm going to do what my sponsor suggests, and I'm going to see where this goes. Because, like I said earlier, the alternative, and I've tried the alternative, whatever that means, countless times has not worked for me, right? And so I think I had convinced myself that the alternative, like I said earlier, was going to lead to me dying or getting put in jail. And so I just tried not to pay attention to it. And I think that's where the step work came in, right? The step work for me was when the game changed. The game around recovery just changed dramatically in terms of how I looked at recovery, how I looked at AA, how I looked at the role that it was going to play in my life.
Did you have a specific moment? Like some people, for me, it was like a specific amends that I made that was really like eye-opening and enlightening for me, or for a lot of people, it's doing a fifth step with a sponsor. What was it for you?
Yeah, it was nine steps. It was in my ninth step. So I I grew up in the Boston area and a lot of my family was there, and my sponsor and I had basically scheduled a trip where I would go back to Boston from LA. It was a 10-day trip. I did 14 amends. I still remember the moment. I think I was 3 days in. I'd done a ninth step with my brother and my sister-in-law. And so I'd probably done 7 or 8 at that point. And I was driving home from my brother's place. It was nighttime. I was driving, and he lives north of Boston. I was driving back into downtown Boston where my parents lived. And I was driving along the water. It was probably 11 p.m. I had a call with my sponsor in L.A. I was letting him know that, you know, the amends, how they were going. I was checking in with him. And I got off the phone, and I was just struck with a level of peace. You know, I was tearing up. I had a level of peace and serenity, a feeling that I had never really had before, where I really felt like I was gonna be okay, and that I was now tapping into a solution that I had never accessed before. You know, there was, so much of the feeling that I chased before was either adrenaline, it was success, it was something on the outside, right? It was hitting a three-pointer. It was being with a girl. It was winning at the poker table. It was, you know, getting a paycheck at work. It was, you know, somebody patting me on the back and telling me how great I was, right? It was getting the respect of other people. It was all these like outside things, right? This moment was just, it was just me and something else. And to me, in hindsight, it was having some level of direct connection with spirituality. And for me, it was God.
So I know that anyone listening right now would be wondering, because I think it would be logical to wonder. So your relationship with your wife, you know, she lives with an addict for 3 years, then you go away for a long time, and then there's that, and now you're back. And, you know, I know that this ends well, but which is great, but I want to know about how did it get from where it was to where it is now?
Yeah, I think... she would come out to Los Angeles more and more as I got more and more sober, emotionally, spiritually fit. You know, we spent a fair amount of time in Los Angeles where she would come visit, but there was clearly still a lot of work to do there. And when I came back to New York, really things didn't change for me all that much in terms of my focus. It wasn't like I had this list of things that I wanted to do for my wife. It was more the idea that I just need to keep my recovery first, and I need to continue to keep my recovery first, and I need to continue to lean in and work with my sponsor. I need to continue to lean in and get a sponsee. Like, I need to continue to do these things that they suggest within the program. And as I started to do those things, our relationship started to get better, right? I started to be more caring, more loving. I started to pay attention more to her in a way that she needed to have attention. I started to become a husband. I started to actually become a good husband, right?
Are you worried at any point, like, I wonder if I can put this back together? Like, will this even work? Was I sober for, you know, I'm going to put it like this. When I picked my wife, I wasn't sober. So did I even pick the right person? Like, all these thoughts, I'm sure, went through your head.
Yeah. I mean, I think there were moments like that. In all honesty, like, because I had seen the results around my recovery, in early recovery, I had seen results around doing what was suggested to me. Through that work, I felt a certain way, and I felt like things were going to be okay. As long as I stayed on that track, I didn't necessarily get caught up in the what ifs,
yeah.
Right?
I think another thing that makes your situation unique is that your wife started going to a different recovery program that has more to do with relationships.
Yeah, so I think, you know, in time, we had repaired our marriage, we had repaired our relationship, we were happy again. You know, I had now gone back to work. I'd found some new opportunities had come my way.
Yeah.
Again, because I think that I had thrown myself into recovery, I had actually changed as a person. And so I was hireable again. People wanted to work with me again. And so like our life for all intents and purposes was back in a way that in some ways it probably had never been. And we were having a lot of success around it. I think one thing though was I was now living this life in recovery and I had this new spirituality. I had new friends in sobriety. I was into new things. I basically was on this new track and I was living this new life. And my wife, for all intents and purposes, was, while things were better, she was still wearing a lot of the things that I had done to her. A lot of the trouble that our relationship had gone through, she was still wearing that. She didn't have the outlet that I had. And so she decided to get help for herself, you know, through the form of her own 12-step recovery program.
Al-Anon, we can talk about it.
Yeah. So she started to go to Al-Anon. It was kind of like one of those things, like, I'm fucking tired of watching you, like, have success, not just, like, in life, but, like, you're happy. You're happy. You're enthusiastic. You're passionate. You have this spirituality thing going on. Like, what the fuck?
And not only that, but there is a language of recovery. There's a language of program. Sure. And when one person in the relationship speaks it and the other person doesn't, in my experience, it annoys the hell out of the other person on the other side of the relationship.
So she was tired of it. And there was probably a 6 to 9 month period of her being tired of it. And that kind of frustration, not really even having a voice. She just kind of dealt with it in her own way. So that was kind of another chapter of, okay. And then so finally she decided to access Al-Anon and she threw herself into that. And, you know, that's been an amazing experience for her because it's allowed her to address a lot of the issues that we have. But I think what's interesting about Al-Anon that I've learned is I think a lot of people associate Al-Anon with, I'm going to go to Al-Anon because of the addict or alcoholic in their life. And what they find is if they actually do Al-Anon for a period of time, it's about them. Yeah. It's about them, the relationships that they have. So my wife has now been able to work on relationships with her parents, with her sisters, with her job, with her relationship with her own identity, with a whole host of things in her life.
And then I know just from speaking to her that then she gets her own sponsees.
Right.
Right. And then she experiences the joy of working with others.
Sure. So she gets the same thing. And the beauty of it is that we can share in our recoveries in the sense that we do talk from, you know, pretty regularly about like what's going on, what are you working on now? Like what's the latest? But we also do it separately, right? We go to different rooms. We have different friends. We have different people that we fellowship with. But it's a beautiful thing. I mean, what's better than that, right? Like you get to work on yourself. You get to help other people in the world that you reside in, and your wife gets to do that alongside you.
Yeah. And I'll get you out on these two things, which is, you know, the first thing is that one of the things that was the most shocking for me when I walked into an AA room is listening to men talk about their feelings in the way that I'd never heard before. And men talking to other men about it. That's why, for the most part, I go to men's meetings. And one of the beautiful things about our friendship, it's one of the most unique ones for me, is that we're able to do that. And so, like, you're one of my closest friends in and out of the program, and I appreciate you. And, you know, I wanted to know what you think for someone new. If you were going to say one piece of advice for a newcomer, what would it be?
Sure. I think when I think back to early sobriety, I found a men's meeting, like I referenced before, in West LA, and how you got respect. And this was a men's meeting of a number of guys that had long-term sobriety. They had a lot of success in life. Personally and professionally, there were people that were looked up to as leaders in whatever world that they resided in. And how you got respect in that room was you got vulnerable, you got honest, you talked about how you felt, and they could sniff you out. If you were full of shit, they'd tell you you were full of shit. And that's how you got respect. And like you referenced, that was contrary to what I knew. And these were a bunch of alphas, right? And you know, showing tears, breaking down, talking about the struggles that you're going through, you got a lot of respect from those guys around that. So I would, you know, what I would say to a newcomer is if you're struggling with something, understand that's to actually talk about what's going on and what you're struggling with, in my opinion, is the greatest exhibition of strength that you can show as a person. Because by being vulnerable, by talking about what you struggle with, you're helping somebody else. You're picking somebody else up. And what's better than that?
My thanks again to James D for coming on the program, having this conversation with me, for being a great friend. Reminder, leave that review on iTunes if you can. Write me at KCB on Instagram. Keep coming back podcast at gmail.com if you want to write in. My name is Mike S. This has been Keep Coming Back, Real Stories of Sobriety and Recovery. I'll see you next week.